Yes, you are being filmed for television, for Seagulls TV and for Latest TV, and like I say, being recorded for Radio Reverb. And yeah, what we're going to do now is going to carry on. AD's got the agenda. I have no idea what we're going to talk about. I'm sure we'll think of something. But yeah,
I'm not sure myself.
And at the end of this, then for those that haven't bought their Ooh Ah Bob Booker book,
I've just signed a few copies, so
yeah, and
we've done all right,
yeah.
Revel.
And for those who
you
want
to have the sweet in the grand tonight, we've done okay. Yeah.
You're under the bed, mate. So we've got.
Are you topping tailing again?
Oh, you can afford to put the jacuzzi on tonight. Crack on, son.
So if anyone does want to buy their copy of the book, I would say this, it is actually an excellent read. I'm not saying this just because Greville's here and I'm after a free room at the Grand. What I would say is for us Brighton fans, it'd be very, very tempting to skip the Brentford and Sheffield United bits because we're not bloody interested. But actually, I think it's, you know, obviously there's a lot of the book is deals with Bob's time at Brighton and Hove Albion. But I think if you want to realise and get a real flavour of the person that joined Brighton and Hove Albion and how he became the person he was through his playing career and all the personalities, do read it. It is a fascinating read. And I think, I can't help thinking actually that by the time you finish reading, you're going to love Bob just that little bit more. So I do thoroughly recommend it. So.
Cheers, right, shall we hit the music?
Well, before we start, now let me say a couple of thank yous. Listen, it's my show, AD. It's my show. Drop down the gear, son.
I'll have the bridal suite at the Grand in that case, if you don't mind. Right, so I think we'll just crack on. So play it again, Sam.
Hello and welcome back to the second half of the Albion Roar special here at the Comedia in Brighton. I'm AD Packham and he is Alan Wares and we are with you in association with allfootballshirts.com. Now, to my right is Bob Booker! Yay! To my left is Mark McGee. Yay! And that's Alan.
I'm here.
Okay, well, I mean, we're going to start. Here is the news. Now, Bob, we're going to talk about apprenticeships. Now, in the modern day and age, that would mean going into an academy or starting right at somewhere like at the Lancing Complex. But for you, it actually meant going into a factory.
Yeah, I left school at, I said to my mum, I left school at 15, 16, didn't take any exams, wasn't interested in school really. Used to get people to do my homework. I was just interested in running and sport, really. Football wasn't on the radar, to be honest with you. And then I wanted to be I always wanted to be a cabinet maker. A good friend of mine there, Bobby Launden, his dad said to him, you get yourself a trade, son, get yourself a trade. He's still doing it 30 years later. Never been a trade, son. But I wanted to be a cabinet maker, so I went down to a furniture factory, quite simply, and just knocked on the door and said, I want to be a cabinet maker. And they said, well, we haven't got any jobs for that. I said, well, I'd really like to do it. And they said, well, we haven't got that, but we've got an upholsterer's job. And I thought he was speaking in Spanish or something. And upholstery was obviously covering furniture. So he said, why don't you do that for a couple of months? And then when the cabinet maker's job comes up, you can go and do that. And there's nothing wrong with cabinet making. It's a skill. It's an art. So I said, yeah, I'll have a bit of that. He said, well, you'd be looking after eight blokes. They want their stuff up front, they want their lunch, they want their tea, they want their equipment, they want their materials. And that was my grounding. That, you know, that was what you call a real proper apprenticeship. And it wasn't in football. I played local park football for Bedman Social, where me and Vinny grew up together. He was a lot younger than me. And that was my life, and I absolutely thrived in it. I loved that factory, and it was my grounding. I think that's what stood me in good stead for my upbringing, really, as a pro, you know, not thinking I was going to get there, but it was tough, but I loved it. You know, my mum used to make bread pudding, and I'd go in and sell it, you know, at 10p, 5p a time. I would go out and get the lads lunch, and then I would go in the record shop and buy some albums, or save it up and buy some football boots, and that's how I survived, you know, and it was a real good ground, and then I got the lucky break to have a trial for Brentford, and funny enough, it was against the Albion.
The question is, though, could you still upholster a sofa now?
Yeah, I could do, I think. I've still got some of the needles up in the loft and that, but hopefully I won't have to go back to that. I think I could do. But you never forget your trade, do you? So it was a special time. And then, I got the lucky break into football.
So tell us about your first foray, in that case, into playing for the Stiffs at Griffin Park.
Well, I was lucky enough. It's all about being in the right place. And the gaffer will know this. Sometimes you need to be in the right place at the right time. And my manager at the time was Dave Bromley, and God rest him now. He's up in the up above us now, and he'll be quite pleased. He's got a mention in the book. So, and he knew a director at Brentford called what's his name, Greville?
Willis Hall.
Willis Hall. See, bring him in, son. And he was. You might remember the programme, some of you older clientele, he did Wurzel Gummidge. Cup of tea and a slice of cake. Just take your dead off and all that. And he said, listen, I've got this lad who's sort of 6 foot plus. He puts himself about a little bit. He scores a few goals. He's only 18. Can he have a trial at Brentford? And I went up there and one afternoon, it was called the Midweek League then, up at Griffin Park against Brighton. Completely out of my depth. I walked in that dressing room. It was like, you know, when you walk into a pub and everybody looks at you thinking, what you meant to be doing here? And I turned up with my little bag and my boots, and as you do, it was just a trial. And all the lads at the factory said, go and enjoy it. And I asked my foreman for the day off. So I went up there and had the trial, and I scored two goals on my trial, which was, I thought, okay, really? That's okay, isn't it? You know, Peter Ward scored a couple who played in that game. And then it sort of led from there, really. The manager at the time was Bill Dodgin. He pulled me in the office and said that we really liked what we saw. Could you come up and do some training? I was in the throes of finishing my apprenticeship. And as my good dad said, you know, get a trade behind you. So I said, well, I'll try and get a couple of weeks off, which I did. Went up there, trained for 2 weeks at Griffin Park with the lads, which was, again, totally out of my depth. But I actually met Andy McCulloch, who really took me under his wing, a great centre-forward. Unfortunately, he went to play for the Pigs, which is Sheffield Wednesday. And, and it was a daunting time being amongst professional footballers. You know, the banter, you know, it was a difficult time. But I came through that, and then after two weeks, he pulled me in the office and said, we'd like to sign you pro. Well, at this time, I was on sort of decent money in 1978, about sort of £200-£250 a week was on piecework. So if they said cover that seat, bloke would come round and I'd take half an hour to do it. Really, I could do it in 2 minutes. So you was always ahead of yourself. So he said, well, we're going to offer you a year's contract and we're going to offer you £60 a week. So I said, right, got to pay my mum 20. haven't got a car. Need a bit of beer money. And that was it. So I went home and told my mum I was signing pro. And she said, oh, that's fantastic. You're going to earn loads of money. I said, well, not really, mum. I've signed for £60 a week. She went, what? So I went into work on the next weekend and told the foreman I was leaving. And that was it. I signed pro.
But he did leave the door open for you to come back if you did go all tits up.
Which I thought it would do. You know, I was going into the big league. I'd been playing Saturday football, you know, amongst, you know, two men and a dog watching. There was about 50 people watching on the trial, and then, yeah, as I say, I ended up sort of making my debut against Watford, which is my home club. It's only my first game in front of 15,000 people, and my family was all in the stand.
I just point out that is chapter 3 covered, okay?
Well, no, you ask me a question, so I know it might be in the book, but it doesn't mean you've got to buy it.
But I mean, this is a story, though, Bob. I mean, it's not something you actually hear, and you probably won't hear again, because the modern football isn't like that. You will very rarely see any of the kids signing, going to these academies now, going into a factory or upholstery or being a builder. Or something.
Well, they won't be. They'll be grabbed at, as Mark will tell you, they'll be grabbed at sort of 11, 12, down at a young age. You know, they won't know any different from coming through their school days straight into the academy. And if you're a young pro now coming up in Sussex and you see that training ground and you see the Amex, the world's your oyster. So for me, it was completely the opposite. You know, £60 a week and just about afford your petrol, had to car share, you know, wash your own training kit, look after your own boots. It was a million miles away from what it is today.
But Mark, is the academy way the right way to go?
I think that certainly in Scotland we're not convinced that it's the only way. There's a lot
a good comes out of academies, and there's a lot of fantastic work being done in academies. But I think that we are great believers, I say we, I'm talking like Gordon and I really, in football being sort of facilitated, you know, so kids playing. We want more, as many kids playing as you can possibly get. And of course, the elite make their way, the best players make their way to the academies. But I think, importantly, at the sort of bottom level, I mean, for instance, you know, Archie, my son who's here tonight, has been at Hove Park every morning over the summer holidays to a football thing that is just about playing. There's not a lot of coaching goes on, but the guys put on matches for them, so they do a little bit of warm-up, they do a little bit of passing, and but mostly they just play. And I think that there's a big case for kids playing more, and the academies will look after themselves, but I don't think they're the be-all and end-all of everything.
Do you ever think that the days of, I mean, let's rewind 50 years this year, from this year, of it being repeated that something like Celtic winning the European Cup with 10 players born within 10 miles of Celtic Park, and even the 11th one was only 30 miles away, is that ever going to happen again?
No, that will never happen again. The competition... you know, even Celtic now, you know, where their team comes from, they do have a basis now of Scottish players. We use them to great advantage in the national team now. Brendan's got them charged and he's got them playing very, very well, Brendan Rodgers. But, you know, the days when that's going to happen, that any club in any, you know, decent level anywhere in Europe, that's never going to happen.
You talk about apprentices as well. I mean, in my day as youth team manager at Brentford, at half time, I had to take the apprentices out on the pitch to do the divots. That's what we did. It's not funny. They didn't like it. It was raining, and they had their suits on, and they were putting the divots in to help the groundsman, because we only had one groundsman. He had one mower, one tractor, and that's what we did. You know, they cleaned the boots, they cleaned the dressing rooms. You know, I would leave there at half past 11, 12 o'clock at night. You know, it's not all roses at that level. These days, the apprentices won't know what cleaning a pair of boots is, because they're not used to it. They don't know that. They've never known that. So in the book, it tells you what it was like to be a footballer in the 80s, a young player, and going into staff at that level as well. It's, you know, it was a bit of a culture shock for a lot of them, and it has moved on considerably, as you know.
But, Mark, you were in a similar situation. You weren't working in a factory so much, but you mentioned Bristol City, but you did actually turn pro with Morton.
Yeah, I went back from Bristol City, having spent 2 years doing an apprenticeship there, doing all the things that Bob's just described and more, you know, painting the railings, you know, laying the track around the pitch.
What did you think of that at the time? You didn't want to do it, did you?
You know, we used to sweep the terraces on a Monday morning, and we used to take turns in being able to play our favourite albums over the tannoy system, you know. So you'd get everything from sort of Led Zeppelin to Yes and... Emerson, Lake and Palmer and all sorts of stuff that
what
nobody's
did you
ever
play?
Heard of, you know. Yeah, I was a bit of a yes man, I must admit. But
well, yours is no disgrace. Yeah.
So I went back from there after 2 years and I signed for Morton, and I was part-time, and I was trained to be an architect, actually. And like Bob, it was a different story altogether, because those days were pre-agent. And there were you didn't get a choice, really. So I was about I was working in an architect's office and training. I was about to go to the art college in Glasgow to study architecture. And one afternoon, I got a phone call from the manager at Morton to say I'd been sold to Newcastle. Could I be at the station at 3 o'clock? And I'm not taking the mickey. That is how it was. I had to phone my dad. My dad came in with a bag with a bits and pieces. I went on a train to Newcastle, and that was me away, and I was no longer going to be an architect. And I had no say in it. You know, I just got there, and Bill McGarry, who was a manager at Newcastle, said, this is what we'll be paying you. And it was a lot more than what I'd been earning, you know, at Morton, between Morton and as an apprentice architect. So it looked brilliant. I made my debut on the 3rd or 4th of January at Leeds, in front of, like, you know, I'd went from playing for Morton, like Bob says, and suddenly... A week later, I was playing at Ellen Road in front of, you know, 50,000. I was playing
against Gordon
McQueen.
Was it more than 60 quid?
Yeah.
Was it more than 60 quid?
It was a bit more than 60 quid, yeah.
Always
but
the prize,
mate. That's how it happened in those days. Nowadays, it's totally different, as you say. From academy level up, it's a different world.
Yeah, and these kids are earning an absolute fortune. And, I mean, all these kids have all got agents, Bob.
Agents, don't talk to me about agents. Shall I tell you a story about an agent?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us, Bob, tell us all.
I'm glad Mark mentioned it. I thought I'd come into that. It's one of the funniest days of my life, and I might have to reenact it a little bit, but I'll have a go.
It'll work well for radio, will it?
Oh, yeah, be all right. Okay. Radio, yeah. I might be going to say. Mark, Gaffer, sorry, Mark. I can't call you Mark. It sounds strange. It's always Gaffer.
Yeah, don't call me Mark.
No? You see, when he stared at me then, that is it. You know you said the wrong thing.
You got to hear that, right?
Gaffer, yeah. He used to give me some telling offs and all. Oh, but there you go. Yeah, agent. So he said, we've got a meeting this morning with Phil Smith, and he's quite a big hitter, quite a big agent as well, isn't he? You know, he's done a few big-time players and that. So he said he's going to come in, and we're just going to talk about some players and that. I said, I've got a little trick, Gaffer. No, you can't do it when there's an agent coming. I said, yeah, we can, come on. I said, I've never met him, but let's go for it. He said, all right, so... In my wisdom, in my drawer, I used to have a few props, you know, a few hats and bits and pieces. And I had a fart machine. I had a fart machine, true story. So Mark's sitting there and I'm sitting here and there's a couple of benches there up at the university, freezing cold. And Phil Smith comes in with his briefcase, all nice and suited and booted, and sits on the chair. And nice to meet you, Phil. I'm Bob Booker. And Gaffer starts talking to me about players and that. So Gaffer's looking at me all of a sudden... I've got the remote control in my hand and the fart machine's under the table. So I've gone... and Gaffer's looked at me like that and bit of a straight face, and Phil Smith sort of not acknowledged it. So I said, sorry, Gaffer. Carried on talking, all of a sudden gone... the next sound, you might have... Anyone got a fart machine? Anyway, so the next sound goes and all of a sudden Gaffer's gone... Phil Smith's not done anything. He's just like talking business. I said, Gaffer, sorry, just had a bad night, got a lot of wind. Do apologise, Phil. He said, no, it's no problem, Bob. Started talking, man. I'm going, throwed another one in. All of a sudden, I said, I'm really struggling with this. Every time I press my stomach, I've got all this wind. And Phil started talking to me. He said, well, you okay? I said, well, not really. And I pushed my stomach, I had the remote control on him. And by this time, his shoulders are starting to go. Right, they're starting to go. I've got him now. Gaffer's looked at me and said, yeah, come on, let's keep it going now. So he started talking, and all of a sudden, I said, oh, I've got to get up. And I got up, and I said, oh, I've really got so much wind with remote control. And I said, when I do this, it's even worse. And I went... By this time, Phil Smith, he's this big agent, he's sliding down a chair. he's rattling like that, his stomach's going. In the end, I've got on the floor and I've gone, it's even better when I do this.
Honestly.
He's in the chair.
I swear to God, it arguably it's the funniest thing I've ever seen. You know? And he keeps his face straight. He says, oh, I'm really sorry, Phil. You know, really. Phil. And Phil, at the beginning, of course, is trying not to kind of laugh, and he's been a bit sympathetic, you know. And like Bob says, he ends up, he's lying on the bench with his tears running down his face, and he's going, oh.
But we used it a few times, didn't we? We had some supporters won a trip up to Sunderland. Was anyone on that trip? You could come on the team coach with the players, didn't you?
What could go wrong?
There's about five or six of them.
No, they flew up.
Oh, they flew up. That's right. Yeah.
The thing is, we signed Mark McCammon after that.
Yeah. So we did the same to them at the dinner, didn't we? But yeah. Also, the last bit I forgot, the fart machine, because I love the fart machine. I've now got the super booster one. It's like, it's 10 different noises. And it goes everywhere with me. Well, I meant to bring it tonight, but we was in the hotel having dinner, and there was two young ladies sitting having a meal, and one of them got up to go to the toilet. I went, I'm in here, Gaff, let's have a chat. So I went, excuse me, can I put this under your table? And when your friend comes back, I've got the remote control, and as she starts talking, I'll press it, and it sounds like you've done a fart. And she said, yeah, that'd be brilliant. So she come back and sat down for dinner, and we're eating a start, and I've gone... And she looked, is that you? What's that? She went, yeah, I know, it must be something I've eaten. And we've done it about five or six times, didn't we?
We'll finish on the fart machine, but the funniest, one of the other funniest ones was when he did it in the Harrods lift.
Oh, you know. I forgot
and
that one.
Myself and Dean White, we'd out for a Christmas night out or something like that, and Dean White and I were standing in front and left, and there was a couple of other...
No, it was packed. The lift was packed. He was at the front.
And he's at the back doing that, and of course the people that go to Harrods were abused.
It was like the Peter Sellers scene. I was at the back, and I could see them two at the front, and I was letting off the fart machine, and him and Dean White are going... By the time we got to the fifth floor, everybody was going... We walked out, I was going, Jesus, who's that? It was priceless.
Cheap joke, but it was funny. Cheap,
yeah. You had to be there.
You tell when an evening's going well, we'll just resort to fart gags.
On that note, we better bring out a fart gag. Mr. Phil Shelley! Hey!
Yes!
This is, of course, Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com, and we do have another shirt of the week. And Phil, who do we need to thank? I can't remember. You did tell me.
I don't know if any of you know about my website. Some of you might do. Oldfootballshirts.com. It's a bit of fun. There's just turned this week 80,000 football shirts from all over the world.
That's incredible. How many languages now, Phil?
The website is translated into about a dozen languages. It's simply fans post pictures of their football shirts. I didn't think it'd be that popular. 80,000 shirts later, it seems to be.
What colour are they, Phil?
What colour? I've no idea. I'm colourblind. However, a good friend of mine, Nick Warwick, has collected a football shirt from every single international team in the world, and he's lent me the Uganda shirt you saw earlier and the one I'm about to show you.
You look like you're falling in a pot of jam.
I'm breathing a lot.
I would say that. Let's have a look.
Okay. So does anybody want to take a guess what team this is?
Ecuador away. Stenhousemuir.
Sheffield United.
Shut it. Listen, I'll do the jokes, all right?
AD, it's over to you, chap.
I like it because there's a word I really want to say on this.
Sorry, can you count? Wait,
can we describe it?
One more thing. These will be posted up on the Albion Raw Facebook page shortly, and I'll also give you a link to Nick Warwick, who's got his wonderful website with a shirt from every single country in the world.
Oh, Bobby.
Okay, so we do need to describe it. So, for those who are listening on the radio, it's kind of like purple with like
flex. It's like about
triangles.
It's like
kind of triangles.
Is this a clue with the European Cup?
No, and it's got a yellow, blue, and red. Yes, yellow, blue, and red. Phil, going down the one side of it with a number 11 on the back. So I'll tell you what this
is. Sorry, quickly, AD. This is the one time while Phil's catwalking that I really wish Bob had his fart machine with him.
Well, he was actually going to wear the shorts and socks as well.
Okay, what shirt is this in, AD?
This is a cracking example of 90s nonsense. It is the 1995-96 home shirt of Venezuela. This rather fabulously, they're known as La Vinto Tinto.
Glad you said that.
And apparently this is due to the colour of the shirt. Makes no sense to me. I thought the shirt was dark green, says Phil. Vinto Tinto, on the other hand. They play at the 37,485 capacity Estadio Olimpico General José Antonio Anzoátegui in the city of Barcelona in the state of Anzoátegui. As of 2017, they're the only Colin Ball side to have never qualified for the World Cup, and they've already been eliminated for qualifying for Russia next year. Their best ever international show was in the 2011 season when they finished fourth in the Copa America. That would do, Phil.
But, so, well done, Phil.
Ladies and gentlemen, Phil Shelley.
Thank you very much. Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com. Okay, well, we did start talking about agents. I suppose we should probably talk about the damage that agents are doing to the game now. And is it the agents that are driving up transfer fees, do you think?
Absolutely not. I think it's the TV companies and the amount of money that's going into the game. And I don't know if it's recklessness, but certainly the people that are financing football clubs, you know, seem to have no limits these days at the top level. So I don't think it's about agents. Agents take advantage of that. And the agents actually are a sort of result of going back to when I first became a manager in the early 90s. There weren't a lot of agents, if there were really any. But what happened was that Sky TV, Sky BSB, came into the game, and the salaries and the transfer fees started to go up then. And what happened was that suddenly chairmen and even managers to a degree couldn't handle
the sort of figures that were being talked about. You know, they couldn't do the deals because they weren't used to doing that sort of level of finance. So what they did is they brought in middlemen. They, football clubs, chairmen in particular, but even managers, introduced mediators, third men, middlemen into the game, and those guys are the agents. So we have ourselves to blame for the agents in the game, and I think that they're not responsible for necessarily driving the fees up. I think that maybe they drive as best they can, they drive the wages up, but you know, the fees far way outweigh, you know, the wages now.
Now, Bob, you never had an agent, did you?
I had my dad. Yeah, when I went to Sheffield United, I had my dad. We travelled up there, and my little red Fiesta. From Brentford, been at Brentford sort of how many years? 10? Yeah, it was you, wasn't it? Get off, Booker, you crap. I knew it was you.
Not just you,
yeah. I didn't have a good time, but yeah. And finally, you know, went to Sheffield United and I took my dad with me. Went into the office like you do with Dave Bassett and Derek Dooley, the chairman, God bless him. We drove up in my little red Fiesta, just about got us up there and pulled into Sheffield United, and you know, fantastic football club, massive stadium. And went into the office and didn't know. Me and my dad were saying, you know, what are you going to ask for? I mean, I was on about £300 a week at Brentford. I don't know. We just spoke about it. I don't know. Let's just see what they say. He said, see what they say, and then we'll go from there. Yeah. But, you know, we just sat down there, and Harry went through, you know, what he's going to get. And it was just, I couldn't keep up with it because it was a million miles. And no disrespect to Brentford, because you know, that was part of my living. It was a massive step up. You know, it was appearance money. The wages were bigger. They're going to give me a sponsored car. They was going to put me in a hotel. This is 1989. They was going to pay for my move up there. It was Looks all right, Harry. Looks all right. Yeah. He said, would you like to go and have a chat with your dad about it? I said, yeah, could we? Like, you know, could we? He said, yeah, all right, go on then. So it was literally like fools and horses. Me and my dad went out to the corridor. And I can't remember a word what Harry said about the wages or the appearance, all that, you know. And we looked at each other and he went, hey, do you want to go first or me? We went, yes! You know, after 11, 12 years in the lower leagues, where it might be longer than that, it was like, oh my God, what's happened to me? I'm 31 years old, my knee's knackered, I'm thinking about packing the game up. It was like fairy story stuff. So knocked on the door and went back in again, and Harry's sitting there laying back in his chair with his feet up like, what do you reckon then, son? What do you reckon then, son? I said, yeah, it looks okay, Harry. It's okay, yeah. A little bit of room for movement or something like that. There's no more money. And so I said, no. He said, you're going to sign then? So I signed like a year and a half contract with a signing on fee. I'd never had a signing on fee. I'd had like a £10 bonus if you scored a goal. So it was like from there to there, and it was quite incredible, you know, the step up.
But you've moved to a strange city. You've grown up in and around London and Watford, but I mean, going up there, were you a bit like a stranger in a strange town?
No, well, I don't know really. You look at it and you think, oh, you're going up there and seeing a football club, you know, and people say, oh, it's, you know, flat caps and whippets and all that. I tell you what, Sheffield was a fantastic city. I loved every minute up there. You know, I was only up there for a short amount of time, but I sort of took to the city and the city took to me, and, you know, it became like home very, very quickly. And I felt, not very quickly, because I did struggle at first because I wasn't fit. You know, I was playing under Steve Perriman, who was playing tippy-tappy football. There's no disrespect to that, but a passing game was, you know, you like to mix up a bit, Gaffer, didn't you? And a little bit of passing, then hit them hard. It was completely different. And, you know, Harry was playing along what they call the long ball game then. You know, get the ball forward and get it in the corners and get a throw in and get a corner. And so in my training sessions, I was coming short to get the ball off the back four. And Harry would be stopping, no, you're not doing that. Forget that. They're going to hit it long to Dean and Agana. And then, okay, so I would be turned around. By the time I got up there for the knockdown, you'd win that, get it wide, and it was fantastic what he put together. I mean, Harry, in his wisdom, he even made the lines bigger so the ball wouldn't go out of play. And and the referees didn't even clock it. You know, he said the groundsman, I want the lines double the width. So if you got it into the corner, and it wouldn't go out for a throw, or it wouldn't go out for a goal kick. And that's what he based his philosophy on. And it worked. You know, a lot of people made a lot of money out, and we, you know, we got back-to-back promotions.
So I'm going to just to say, before we carry on, we're probably going to do about another sort of 10, 15 minutes, but what we will do shortly, I forgot to mention this at the top of the show, is that we'd like to throw open a Q&A. So if you sort of if you can work a question into your head that you'd like to ask either Bob or Mark towards the end of the show, then we'll throw the floor open to you.
Can't we keep going a bit longer? I've got some more stories yet.
By all means. Well, I was going to actually ask about the one you...
Cause,
the story starts in a... Actually, the story ends in the pub. Before we came on air this evening, you were telling us about my favourite band, and probably yours as well, about you two at a Who concert, and you were reminiscing. Do tell.
Yeah. Well, I've been a Who fan since 1972. It was one of the first albums ever brought. I'm sad that there's a watch, limited edition. Cost me a lot of money, that. So big infinity with the band, but I said to the gaffer, like, you know, come, let's go up and see the Who. I'll take you to see the Who. Managed to get some tickets, because... been watching them for so long, and I managed to get backstage, you know, sort of tickets for the gig. Shepherd's Bush, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Shepherd's Bush, yeah. And yeah, Gaffer said, yeah, come. But just quickly, we was in there, we'd had a drink, and we were just standing there, and we started talking we must have played against each other, didn't we? For, you know, Newcastle and Sheffield United. Because Newcastle were going for the championship, and we were sort of just tucking in behind them. And we were just sort of talking, sort of lightly before the band come on. And this young, well, not young lad, this lad turned round, and he went, I was at that game at Bramall Lane. He didn't recognise me, he recognised him. Because he was Charlie Big Potato at Scotland, wasn't he? But he was a legend up there. So he said, I was at that game. And we looked at each other and went, really? He said, yeah, I was a little lad and I just heard you talking.
It's absolutely true. Yeah. In fact, I remember more about that, because I remember that Bob said to me, you know, that they were playing this smaller gig before they played Earls Court. And... he said, I'd love to get tickets for that. And I remember saying to Bob, I think I know somebody that could get us tickets. And then I come back to him and I said, look, I can get tickets, but they're like 100 quid each. And he said, look, I've got to see that. So we paid the 100 quid each. When we came out of the subway, there was like 1,000 guys selling tickets. Tickets, 20 quid. Tickets, 20 quid. Remember that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
He's like me. Ah, well done, you know.
You paid.
And then we went into... I'm repeating it, I know, but it was astonishing because we're standing there in this crowd of maybe 1,500 people and waiting for the concert to start, and standing with our beer in a plastic mug. And he says, you know, I remember, you know, we played that game. And absolutely, as Bob says, this boy taps his shoulder. I was at that game. You know, you can't believe it, you know. Right, anybody else in London that night had been at that game, you know. It was funny.
Sounds like a game in Brentford that a certain Gary Nelson played in and scored a goal in front of 40,050.
So, OK, let's rewind here, because, Bob, you just sort of put a frown upon your face. Let's rewind to 1987. Brentford against Brighton in the FA Cup.
87?
87.
Where at?
Griffin Park.
Can't remember that. Did I play?
Yeah.
It's a blank.
FA Cup first round. Brighton beat Brentford. I think it was either 2-1 or 2-0. Gary Nelson scored, having beaten... Well, the story goes from about 6, but if you ask him, it'll be about 54 defenders. Before launching one into the top corner, you have no recollection?
No.
God, you're crap.
It's in your book.
Is it?
Yeah.
That's down to him.
Greville, did he play in it? And do you remember the game?
He was offside.
Yeah. He actually picked up the ball in his own half. Is there anyone else here that was there that day?
All of us.
As a Brentford fan, it was a
It was. So, and the fact that it's, I'd like to think in that case, Bob's being sort of, he must have been the fellow that was beaten 3 times in all that dribble then.
Yeah, I remember playing Brighton at Sheffield United.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Didn't mind about that.
Never heard of him. Actually, he's got a very good book out.
He's got 2.
Not quite as good as mine, but it's not bad.
Okay. Well, I mean, so you took him to the Who. Did you take him to see Def Leppard as well?
No, I didn't take him to see Def Leppard. It was a bit out of his league, really. Def Leppard, yeah. That's a little story, really, because I was a big Def Leppard fan. And it's strange, isn't it? I was a Def Leppard fan many, many years ago. And they came to London once in their Union Jack shorts and this, and they done one gig. And then I got transferred to Sheffield United, and I was in the bar afterwards, and the local DJ come up, who's done a similar job to my good lady Nikki there, and said, oh, you're a Def Leppard fan. I said, yeah, how do you know that? He said, oh, well, Joe Elliott, the lead singer, he's a Sheffield United fan, and Rick Savage is a Sheffield Wednesday fan. I went, Joe Elliott's a Sheffield United fan? He went, yeah, he wants to meet you. Wants to meet me? he wanted to meet me. So he took me into the boardroom and bumped into Joe Elliott, and we sort of hit it off, and you know, he was interested that my interest in Def Leppard, and we became good buddies, and we still are. And I invited him to my first wedding. I say my first wedding because I liked it so much I've done it twice. Yeah, so he came to my first wedding, and I went down to the Hilton Hotel and asked for Joe Elliott, and he said, "We haven't got a Joe Elliott here." And then I said, "Well, yeah, you have. He's for Def Leppard," and he put his name in as Mickey Mouse and didn't tell me, so he wouldn't get badgered. So I went up to his room, and he was in his room with his lady friend. I think it was a lady friend, and he said, "There's your present, son. There's your wedding present." And I opened it up, and it was a platinum disc of their album, which is 30 years today, of Hysteria. I thought, wow, that's, yeah. I've had to scratch the first wife's name off. I've had to get that off, but that cost me a few quid. But I'd done that, and so I thought, blimey, when it was his wedding, what do you buy a multi-million-pound rock star? So I gave him a number 4 shirt with the. From a game I played in, and he totally loved it. He had it framed and put it above his bed, and he was happy. But when he said to me, he said, "Oh, can I coming over to the wedding?" He's coming over from Ireland because he's a tax exile, and he said, "Oh," he said, "book me into the Hilton." So I did that, and he come over in a little Fiesta, real low key, and come to the wedding, and a lot of Sheffield United players come down, and he was on the camcorder and all that. All the Sheffield United players had a right good night, and then. Little they didn't, I was going back to the house that I had at the time with my wife, and they was all booked into the Hilton. So as they went into the Hilton, all the Sheffield United players and a load of people, Joe Elliott was with them, and they had a piano in reception. So he went up to the piano and just started doing a bit of a set for about 20, 25 minutes. And of course, Jobsworth come up, didn't he, Porter, and said, "Excuse me, mate, you can't play that in here." And he went, "If it was Elton John, you'd let him. Now piss off." And that was a true story. So he done about an hour set on the piano. It was absolutely amazing, apparently. I was at home reading my wedding cards. I know where I should have been.
Okay, well, we were talking about transfer fees and stuff earlier, and the Albion have just paid 15 million quid for a player, Mark. What was the most they ever let you spend?
Careful.
I'd probably spend more in Archie's boots than I spend in a player.
Hey, hey. Your boots cost 15 million.
Really, I think I paid close to £1 million for Steve Corica when I was at Leicester. Apart from that, really never had any money at any of the clubs I was at to spend on players.
Well, one player you did spend money on was Colin Kazim-Riches, which was a bit of a windfall through a Coca-Cola promotion, and he was nicknamed the Coca-Cola Kid. But he was quite tricky to get on with. Is that fair?
You can swear.
You can answer. You can answer this one.
I think. I think Colin has went on and done well on the back of the, you know, us taking him as we did, but you know he didn't fulfil any of the potential that we hoped that he would when he was here. Really, you know.
Do you remember when he came down the training session with a T-shirt on?
What I do also remember, Bob, is I remember that when he went to Sheffield United, didn't he?
Yeah. Never been a blade.
Neil Warnock phoned me and he said, he's tricky, like you say, you know, he's a difficult character. And I said, well, yeah. I said, he's got physique, he's athleticism. I said, he's a beast of a boy. He strikes the ball as hard as anybody you'll ever see. I said, but, you know, he doesn't conform, as it were. And he says, okay, he says, I'll give it a go anyway. He says, and if he doesn't do it within 3 or 4 weeks, I'll piss him off. You know, so he took him knowing that he'd probably get rid of him if he didn't buckle down. I think that's basically what happened, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I mean, he did go on to have a decent career. He went on to play for Galatasaray and obviously Turkey a few times. But, I mean, I guess that's just the modern player mentality. Is that something you see on a day-to-day basis?
Absolutely not. I think that is a rare thing these days to see a lad like that who has that sort of, you know, sort of attitude. The modern player today is so professional. I mean, working with the Scottish lads, I mean, my God, the way their food... They're all linked up to their own clubs by GPS and all the stuff that they do. They get reports. Maybe we had one incident a couple of years ago with James MacArthur, who at the time, I think, was at Wigan. I don't think he was at Palace. I think he was at Wigan.
When I said you can, when I said you can swear, I mean there's limits.
And we had their physio at the club contact our physio in the Scotland squad and say that he had trained for 20 minutes too long, like over like 4 days. We just need to bring this to your attention. But you know, he trained 20 minutes too long. Gordon was like, well, you can imagine what Gordon said, you know. But that's how they take it. These guys are the professionalism is just unbelievable. And I think that's, you know, you think about the Brighton lads, that division, the Championship, and even down into the lower divisions now, it's all filtering down. They look after themselves. They do. So that is a rare thing nowadays.
Well, there was one player that was quite popular in a game at Sheffield United, but he's more famous for anything he did in the game was for being pushed over an advertising hoarding. And that was Mark McCammon, Mr. McGee. Now, what happened in Burnley?
I will answer it. I mean, basically what happened was... I felt that he had a really poor first half. I felt that, you know, that the rest of
he had a poor season, he said.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
So he hadn't pulled his weight, where the others I felt were, you know, trying. I think I'm right in saying that we were losing 1-0 at half time, I think. Mm. And as I came in the door at half time, ahead of me I can hear his voice. And he had quite a distinctive voice. He'd quite you know, so didn't he? He kind of a twangy voice, you know. And all I could hear was his voice criticising and questioning others. So I came in the door and I said, wait a minute, you know. You sit down and just you keep quiet because you've got nothing to say because you're the guy that's, you know, least of all has performed in the first half. Anyway, he took exception to that and he actually, without me really realising it, he disappeared out of the dressing room. And I said, as I went to go back out, Dean White said to me, Gaffer, McCammon's down the passageway. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, he's saying he's not going back out. I said, what? He said he's upset because I had a go at him. I said, right, Jake, get ready, you know. So Jake Robinson went on, and Jake Robinson, I said, I can't remember, did he score? Yeah. And he actually did quite well. He did really well, actually. And I think we drew the game 1-1. So at the end of the game, I go off and I do the press. And inside, I'm absolutely seething at, you know, McCammon. So when I come on the bus, there he is sitting, and I say to him, where do you think you're going? And he said, Brighton? I said, no, my bus, you know. Get your bag and get off. So I put him off the bus. And I always remember, we're driving out of the car park, and he's walking out the car park with his bag, and then about 20 minutes down the road we get a phone call from the police saying that one of the Brighton players is walking down the Joe Carriage with his bag. I said, it's not any Brighton player that I know. So, but the best part of it was on the Monday morning. I don't know if you used to remember in the Sun, but they used to do this thing where there used to be like snippets or something it was called. And in the middle of the report on the game, they had this box and it said snippets, and it was something to do with the game. And it was his train schedule back to Brighton. So it was like
5 changes.
6:40 Brighton to Crewe. 7:10 Crew to Birmingham, you know, Birmingham to somewhere else to London, London to, you know, arrived in Brighton 2:30 a.m.
He did have one good game for Brighton, I seem to remember, against Sunderland, and Adam Virgo got sent off for a change. Right, but I mean, you did work under. We've got to talk about the other managers you worked under, Bob. So, I mean, let's start with the first one, which was Mickey Adams. Obviously, he. Do you think he would have ever brought you down here if he didn't find you sleeping rough in the Griffin Park?
I don't know. I mean, you know, that was my first meeting of Mickey, and he came into the dressing room, and I was only the youth team manager then. I was nothing really. Kevin Locke was the assistant. And Berkey was the groundsman. I got in the job. And we were just standing in the dressing room. And Mickey came in with Glenn Cockrell. Glenn Cockrell was a right nice lad. And I remember he had crocodile shoes on. He looked horrendous. He thought he was Rod Stewart. And Mick just said, oh, you know, you don't really know me. And I played against him because I scored 2 against Southampton at Bramall Lane. And he played. But I didn't want to remind him at that time because he'd just come in as the gaffer. And he just said, you know, we'll give you a chance. And Mark was talking about this earlier, you know, coming in with a new staff, and we'll give you a chance as a staff member, and if you shape up, we'll go with it. If you don't, then you'll be out the door, and that's how it was sold. You know, I just want a bit of loyalty and a bit of trust, and I want you to work hard. We said, yeah, no problem, Gaffer. And he walked out with Glenn Cockrell. Well, at that time, because I was youth team manager, I didn't have time to get home because I lived in Watford, and I wouldn't finish at the ground till 11 at night after a first team game. So me and the groundsman, we slept in the rest room on little camp beds.
So you slept with a groundsman as well? There's a bit of a pattern here,
yeah,
Bob.
Like that, son. Yeah, I know. We did. We slept with, you know, we go and get our kebab after a couple of drinks and all the apprentices gone home. We slept in the restroom and Mickey was leaving and he saw the two camp beds and he come back and he said, Bob, what's with all the camp beds in the restroom? I said, we asked for a bit of loyalty and a bit of trust and a bit of commitment, so we're sleeping over tonight. And he looked at me and went, I like that. And that was the bonding of me and Mickey Adams. And then, unfortunately, we went down and he left and come back down to Brighton. And I remember him coming down the stairs after he was leaving. He had his little fridge coming down the stairs. And he was a bit like Mark, really. Mark talks about we all the time, and Mick was like that. Mark was really good with the staff members. We were a team. It's not about the manager and the assistant. It's about the team. And on a Friday, Mick would invite us up, you know, to his office before we drove home to Watford, sit in his office, have a couple of beers with the groundsman as well. And he just got everybody together. And that was the sort of spirit that you built up like. And that's precious, that sort of commitment. And when he finally left, and he just said, I'll be watching you. And then he came down and Corky left. And I got the phone call from Mickey to come down to Brighton. So I went in. I wasn't in a happy place at the time. I was sort of down the pecking order. Ron Nodes had come in with the dream team, Ray Lewington, Brian Sparrow, and Terry Bullivant. And then there was Jeff Taylor, who was the youth team director. And I was sort of way down here doing all the kit and the boots and completely out of it. So I just went into the office of the managing director. I said, oh, I'm leaving for Brighton. He said, when are you going? I said, how about tomorrow? And I was trying to change my contract at the time, but David Webb had put me onto a rolling contract. So I said, well, no, I'm going tomorrow. I'm going to go down to Brighton. And he said, what, as youth team coach? I said, no, I'm going down as assistant manager. I'm going to get my company car, my company credit card, my company phone, and my expenses, and I'm going tomorrow. He went, yeah, okay, then, yeah, no problem. And that was it, because I was just, you know, didn't have all them trimmings as a youth team coach, so it was a massive step up.
And, of course...
Sorry, yeah. Didn't mean to go on too long there.
But of course, Mickey did bring a lot of players with you at Brentford as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, the Danny Cullips and the Charlie Oakway and Paul Watson. I mean, precious, precious squad players, like. And, you know, it was a massive step up for me. And as a coach and not an assistant manager, then I wasn't an assistant manager, I was just a youth team coach. I've been dealing with, like, 15 to 17-year-old boys, which I could bully and not bully physically, you know what I mean? But I could discipline them. I could discipline them. You know, I could tell them to clean the dressing rooms and things like that. So my first training session was we was up in the office, and he said, "There you go. Then they're out there waiting for you." I said, "What do you mean? You're not coming with me? You're on your own, son." And he sent me out to the likes of Aspinall, Cullip, Carpenter, Oakway, waiting there for me to give them a masterclass in coaching. It weren't going to happen. So
that reminds me. How many times did you get de-bagged?
Yeah, too many. Not that day, anyway. But I just went about my stuff and had a bit of banter with the lads. And I think, you know, instantly, I think we sort of took to each other. And you just build a bond, don't you? And you are the link between the manager. You know, sometimes he needs to know if someone's doing something wrong. Sometimes you need to deal with it, players would sort of talk to me and say, can you go and tell Little Legs, because that was his nickname, I'm not happy. Now, you come in from training, as Mark will know, and you get a phone call from the agent because the player's been sent off from training. He's got on the phone and the agent comes and rings up and says, why isn't he travelling tomorrow? Because he's trained crap this week. That's why he ain't travelling. That's what you could do in them days. But so I had that lot in front of me and took a training session, and then they debagged me, which was down to my slip, and dragged me around the training ground and kicked me and punched me and put mud in my mouth and mud up my other parts. And that was my debut. That was my
initiation.
Initiation.
But normal for Brighton on a Friday night.
Yeah. But, you know, you just have to take that, you know. Yeah. And Corky took it, and then, you know, I took it. So, and I had many of them over the years.
Okay, well, Mickey was successful, of course, winning the title, but he got poached by Leicester, so he went up there. And then Peter Taylor came in. Now, who does the best impressions?
Peter Taylor, Norman Wisdom, the best. Absolutely really? The best. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Mr. Grimsdale! he does a good one, yeah. But Peter, I mean, I didn't know Peter's... as much as I knew Mark either. He just came in his first day in training. I met him down the training ground. We was training, I think it was St. Christ then, because the training ground was underwater, and just went into the dressing room. And he, you know, I think we was on a bit of a roll then. You might remember, you know, the lads, you sort of felt like they was going to push on and possibly win it again, but you knew when they was in a roll, you know, you wasn't coaching them too much. They just did things on a daily basis and you just kept it going. I think Peter spotted that. So he just said, go out and do your normal morning training on a Friday morning. I said, no problem then, Gaffer. So I'm jogging around with the lads. I've got Oakway, Carpenter, all the Herberts, Art and Jones, saying, what's he like? I said, I don't know, I've only just met him. It's the first time I met him. He's just told me, you know, we're just going to have a warm-up with him and he's going to introduce the training session. So I brought the lads round. He said, yeah, okay, Bob, just set up what you normally do on a Friday morning. Well, in them days, all managers do it different. Mark's got his own ideas and Mick had his own ideas. A lot of it's quite similar, but you just... go off on your tangent. So I set up a five-a-side and blew the whistle for 7 minutes each way. And there's Danny Cullip going into Gary Hart, knocking him in the air, two-footing Nathan Jones, Charlie Oakway, elbowing people. And I'm standing next to Peter Taylor, who gave David Beckham his debut, and I'm thinking, yeah, he'd be happy with this, wouldn't he? And he's not... I'm trying to catch his eye, and I'm not getting anything from him. And he's standing there with his FA whistle around him and his stopwatch, thinking... I'm thinking, yeah... blows the whistle, woo, 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 woo. All up like that, cuts and socks are down and everything. He said, Bob, what the hell's going on? I said, well, we're training, Gaffer. He said, no, no tackling. And Charlie Oakway and Kerry May are going, no tackling. Danny Callick's like, got veins coming out like, on a Friday morning. Because that's what they did. And he said, no tackling. And he stopped it there and then and started doing all this, like, you go to A, you go to B, you go to C, you go to D. And I'm like, Kerry and all that going on. And it wasn't what they was about. And I think he recognised that after a couple of training sessions. And he let it flow. I mean, we didn't always have a five-a-side in the morning. But the lads would be coming up to me and saying, oh, I need some extra work, Bob. So after on a Friday morning, I'd give them, like, dog ears and keep them going. But every manager does it different.
Well, there was a game under Peter Taylor where it all kicked off. And that was against Chesterfield with Dean. And we didn't really get on very well with Nicky Law, I seem to remember. Mm. And someone got their head shoved through a Coke machine. Is that right?
Oh, I think it all went off in there in the dressing rooms, didn't it?
I think it was actually Gary Hart. Oh, I'm going to name names here. Gary Hart said that Michelle Cope has saved him from getting his head rammed into the Coke machine.
Yeah.
This is the team you inherited, Mark. And we still got promoted. Let's set the scene. I'm sure most of us remember it. The previous season, we'd beaten Chesterfield to win the fourth division. Then we go forward to about Christmas 2001, I think it is. Dodge comes on, gets as a substitute. 7 minutes later, receives his second yellow card for a crazy thigh-high lunge. And Nicky Law is giving it large. And the game finishes 2-2. And then into the dressing room, it kicks off. Please tell me you remember everything. Or was it such a common occurrence, Bob, that...
No, I remember, like, all steaming into the dressing room and trying to separate players and...
Was it the floor gave way or something?
Yeah, the floor gave way. I mean, yeah. It was
a porter... that happens all the time.
It was a porter cabin. It wasn't... Like Mark said earlier, they were porter cabins, but they did get better, didn't they? They did get better. So it just... Listen, that's football stuff. It kicks off in the dressing room and... you know, the fists are flying, you're trying to separate players and it all calms down and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we got the result we wanted.
We've got to move for it because we are going to be running out of time, Sue. So we're Martin Hinchelwood, right man, wrong time?
Right, yeah. Nice man, wrong time. Next one.
Now, Steve Coppell, his first game in charge was with Dean, and it was a game against your former club. It was a game that was refereed by someone called Phil Prosser.
Don't know. Who's he?
He's a referee.
Oh, right, yeah. No. Oh, I remember, obviously, Steve Coppell, yeah, very, you know, it's... I was a bit in awe of Steve Coppell. I wasn't in awe of you, Gaffer, because I could see we were going to be good drinking partners. But Steve Coppell was slightly different, a very intelligent man, a bit like yourself. But he was a little bit different. He was very reserved and, you know, he sort of let things, me get on with things, and he would just come in and do his own little bit and step in and say that bits and pieces and things like that. And but he sort of grabbed it, and he, a bit like Mark, I think he really enjoyed this football club, and he was gutted when we went down, and obviously he moved on to Reading and that, but he really enjoyed his time here, and he was into video analysis and things like that. He brought that in, he did his own stuff, and you watched it, and the players bought into it for as much as they could, and they sort of took it on board. So yes, Steve was an interesting character. But
the next was a bloke called Mark McGee. What do you think of him?
Well, I only knew Mark.
He's the bloke that sold Adam Virgo for £1.5 million.
Exactly. Good business,
to his
Gaffer,
mate.
Wasn't it?
To my best part.
Do you remember the day you come and told the players when you walked out onto the training pitch? Go on, tell them when you walked out. And
go on, remind me.
Well, you just Well, you just sort of walked down, all the players were there, and you just sort of, you know, said you might wonder why Virgo is not here, and he's gone for £1.5 million. Wasn't it? And we all sort of a bit of silence, and we all shrugged our shoulders. Right, we'll go off for a warm up then. And you could just hear the lads, £1.5 million. I've been here for 4 years, and I've never had a move. So yeah, but great bit of business. But because you was pals with Gordon, and Gordon used to come down. the wee man, and Virgs was like indestructible. You know, the gaffer decided to play him up front. It worked. He played him at centre midfield. He hurt people. He was athletic. He had all the tools, so, and Gordon was seeing this, wasn't he? Sort of week in, week out.
Any of you that were around at that time, Adam Virgo almost single-handedly got us promoted. I don't care what anybody says. Now, what happened at that time was Gordon wasn't working, so Gordon used to come to a lot of our games, and every time he came, he saw Adam Virgo play well. He played, as Bob said, right back, centre-half, left side. He played left side, centre-half, and the three at Tottenham. I remember Don Howe, who was working as a FA coach for the education programme then, telling me that he used our performance playing three at the back that day as an example to show students at the course how to play with a back three. You know, Adam Virgo played as a left side centre half. He played every position. He was our top goal scorer. I think he only had about 7 goals, but he was still a... 9, was it? Mm. Yeah. So he's still our top goal scorer, you know. So what coincidentally happened was, and this had happened before, it happened when I was at Wolves, because Gordon, being close to me, used to come to a lot of Wolves games. So while everybody else was hesitating about Robbie Keane and wondering where does he play, how do you play him, Gordon had seen him more because he was coming to Wolves games because of his friendship with me. He saw Robbie Keane and he bought him for whatever it was, 10 million, you know. And it was the same with Adam Virgo. Every time Gordon seen him play, he was like man of the match. So it was kind of understandable that Gordon went for him. The fact that we got £1.5 million, wasn't largely down to me, but it was in many ways was down to Dick. Dick, you know, drove the bargain, drove the deal. I kept saying to him, look, you know, you'll get more, keep pressing. But, you know, he was responsible for getting the 1.5.
I would say this actually as a footnote to Adam Virgo's history. He's also the, I think, equal, if not top on his own, the one Brighton player in the entire history of the club with the most red cards. True.
You know, I don't even remember him getting sent off.
Him and Hayden Mullins are particularly good friends.
Yeah, I think he's got 8 or 9, is it?
8, yeah.
I think that's one of those stats that in Adam Virgo's time at Brighton is irrelevant. He did the job.
Mm. He did. When you moved into, you obviously saw something in him to move into centre forward. And you told him it was only meant to be for the bank holiday weekend.
Yeah, but, you know, he did brilliantly, and we used him in that capacity a few times. No, he did well for us. He was part of a strong team, but, you know, I remember he scored a winning goal at Leicester, I think, away. Mm. You know, he scored important goals.
Mm. Yeah, he did. You know?
Okay, I mean, I think we were actually running, I mean, obviously... Bob and Mark are such great raconteurs. We're actually sort of running short time, so we're not going to be able to get our Q&A session in. Sorry about that. So,
boo.
So I do actually, and I think we're going to have to sort of truncate some of this, so we're going to have another one easy and get another 10 out of each of you for these. So, but I do have to ask this of you, Mark. I mean, we've talked about so many sort of things through the evening. I hope that you've, you know, learned a few things and had a few good stories too. But in your current...
Excuse me, I need a toilet.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. I know you inherited him, but I mean, there's just some things, isn't there? Right, well, we'll carry on. In your capacity as the assistant manager at Scotland, I've just wanted to ask this: how do you feel how would you actually summarise the state of Scottish football at the moment? I mean, when I grew up, 70s and 80s, you know, they were probably on a par with England. But you know, these days, how would you summarise the state that Scotland's in at the moment?
The domestic game is struggling because of the finances. You have to understand that, you know, we don't get, in Scotland, the clubs don't get the sort of return from TV and all that they get even in the first division in England. You know, so, for instance, a club like Motherwell or Kilmarnock or Dundee, their budget for all football matters would be around £1 million. Celtic, you know, their budget is around 35 million, you know. So it's not a coincidence that they win the league every year. I spoke to a championship club last year who barely stayed up. I spoke to their manager. Their budget is something like 10.5 million and they spent 7 million, you know. So it's not about, there's good people, you know, there are good coaches, there are good managers and there are some good players, but it is all about the finances, you know. They can't compete. When Scottish clubs are looking for players, they're going to the National League or they're going to the second division. They cannot sign players from even the first division.
Is there a grassroots issue, though? Because, I mean, obviously, back in the day...
No, there's not. Because, you know, we for instance, the other night, we've got Andy Robertson, who's now at Liverpool. He's come through Queen's Park 4 years ago. We were laughing about this, but 4 years ago, he was at Queen's Park. But he was also working in the ticket office at Hampden. You know, the boy Kearney come through the Celtic Academy, all that sort of thing. You know, there are players coming through. There are good young players coming through. But, you know, it's limited by the finances that the clubs have in terms of making it a competitive league where English clubs go out and buy all these guys from Europe and from around the world. We're not able to do that.
But isn't the fact that the English clubs are going out and buying all these players from Europe instead of scouting the lower leagues like they used to and pick up, well, what used to be a bargain, that's hurting the progression of players in this country and in Scotland?
Yeah, but they've got to be good enough. You know, at the end of the day, there are still players will come from a lower level if they're good enough. There's a statistical thing going on as well. Where there are less players playing football in Scotland than there were when I was, you know, 15 or 14, for all sorts of reasons, facilities, you know, Game Boys, all the stuff that they've got nowadays. So there are less players playing, therefore there are less players emerging. But the main problem with the professional leagues is the finances.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you think that there will be another batch of the of players like Kenny Dalglish, like Graham Souness, etc., coming through?
Like Mark McGee.
Not without a change to, you know, the way the clubs are, the way the clubs are able to support the you talk about the grassroots. No, I don't think that will happen.
Well, I would say this, that we've had, you know, the chap sitting next to me here, he's played for Morton, for Aberdeen, for Celtic. But would you please welcome to the stage our very own Queen of the South?
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big... singing, we will, we will rock you. We will, we will rock you. Buddy, you're a young man, hard man, shouting in the street, you're gonna take on the world someday. You got blood on your face, a big disgrace, waving your banner all over the place. Somebody better put your bag into your place. We will rock you. Sing it. We will rock you. Everybody, we will rock you.
And that is it. That is all we got time to. So, of course, thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you to Mark McGee. Thank you to Freddie Mercury. And thank
Cheers,
you to Bob Booker.
Listen, just quickly, thank you for everybody for turning out tonight. It means massively to me and to Mark and the guys. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Wish we could have stayed longer. I am signing books afterwards. $12.99 on Amazon. $9.99 on the Kindle. Get it for Christmas. It's not about that. It's about you, fans. Thanks for all your hard work over the seasons. And let's just remember a lot of people that haven't got to that stadium who we've lost. Just have a think about them as well.
Absolutely.
God bless you.
This has been the Albion Roar. We'll be back at the weekend. Thank you very much.
And
see you again soon.
Thanks. By the way, rest in peace, Freddie. That is it. It's going into the shed and going to grow gracefully with cobwebs on it. Love you all. God bless.
Thank you, good night!